Many soils of the Mid-Atlantic region have been influenced by both the land and the sea. And soil minerals in many places have accumulated under marine estuarine conditions and experienced what I call sulfidization. And that this was during the geologic past for the sediments and sedimentary and even metamorphic rocks, we think, now exposed in the upland. It's interesting that we're finding active acid sulfate soils out on metamorphic rocks now, one notable place in Virginia, but I'm sure it's in many other places as well. So these are exposed in uplands, but this sulfidization process is going on in current tidal marshes and subaqueous soils. And of course then, sulfide-bearing geologic materials influenced by the sea during their deposition have been exposed on land to oxidizing conditions that promote sulfuricization. And some mineral transformations during both these processes go on very rapidly, as we talked about before. And so the goals of my presentation are to enhance awareness of the land-sea cycles that many soil materials experience, to dramatize the rapidity of some of these transformations, and to point out some influences that these transformations have upon the nature and genesis of the soils and their mineralogy. And this is just a listing of the groups of minerals that I want to try to say something about. There are the iron, sulfur, oxygen minerals, the silicon, silicates, and silica minerals, and then calcium, a bit about calcium and carbonates and versus gypsum. And then to remind us that seawater is relatively rich in potassium, something like, I believe, 300 parts per million. And it does get into glauconite and illite from the sea during the deposition of sediments. And in uplands, during sulfuricization, we get it going into jarosite. And this is a summary diagram, and I'm presenting it now because I think it's quite likely that I may not get all the way through this presentation before I have to get yanked off the stage. So I thought I'd give you my summary first, and then we'll get to illustrate some of it. But what I'm attempting to illustrate is the land and the sea, and I guess just for a place that this might be, it might be around Annapolis, Maryland, where we have some rolling uplands underlain by Eocene, Upper Cretaceous sediments, even Miocene, and have glauconite, diatomaceous earth, some pyrite and things in it, and then nearby Chesapeake Bay. But this is tended to be very general. And actually, we do find these unoxidized zones going all the way back to the Appalachian Mountains, where we have coal seams and things of that sort. Also, now we're thinking more and more in the Piedmont and many places in the coastal plain. And I guess what I want to start out on here is just to say repeat some of this previous slide of some of these elements that get deposited in the sea as sulfides by reduction of sulfate of seawater and combination of iron coming from the iron and iron oxides of sediments. We do have diatoms and glauconite. I can't say that we have modern-day glauconite formation, but I'm trying to get my colleagues who are studying these subaqueous soils to take a look at this, see if there isn't, they can't find some of that. So we'll mention that a little bit. And then we have the calcium going into by biogenic deposition of shells. And then we have the potassium again that presumably gets into the silicates. And then once upon a time I did a paper when I was an undergraduate in college on geology history, and the The person who impressed me was Charles Lyell, who gets credit, I think, for being one of the first geologists. And his philosophy was the present is the key to the past. And so this out here is our present as far as the geology of these things up here goes. And so I'm trying to make us think that it was once upon a time materials like this were out in an environment like that, but then by geologic consolidation and uplift, we have them today in uplands. And this is, I think, anywhere where we have sedimentary rocks that accumulated in the sea side environment. And in fact, I was thinking of playing ebb tide as this thing went along. But anyway, just keep that in your mind. But anyway, we do get these things then to the uplands. And I'm implying here a single oxidized zone over a single unoxidized zone. This doesn't pertain everywhere, but it's amazing to me how many places it does seem to pertain at. And then we have the transformations that have taken place at some time. Who knows how much erosion has gone on here. But anyway, we have also the deepening of the oxidized zone, which presumably goes faster than the rate of erosion if we have an oxidized zone. And then we think about the mineral transformations that take place across this boundary. And this is where active sulfuricization goes on. It may not go so rapidly beneath a cover, but as it does when we expose this rapidly by excavation and then get a real active acid sulfate soil here. But we have evidence, one of the main ones being the presence of jarosite in some of our soils, which are ultisols and things of that sort, which we think formed as this oxidation front went down. And we don't find any jarosite down here. The jarosite is up there. We don't find any pyrite up here, but we find pyrite down there. And so I'm also implying that an awful lot of the iron in iron oxides and in jarosite and all these iron, quote, oxide-type minerals originated from the oxidation of sulfides. It's hard for us to appreciate that when the oxidized zone may be 20 meters thick, but in most cases we don't find them that thick, but we do find it thicker than the two meter deep zone that we commonly look at when we classify. And so I maintain that really this is the true sea horizon down here where we have lithologic continuity. And actually, one of our former students, Darmody, liked to call this the D horizon. That up there is a C. That's bullshit. This stuff formed from that kind of stuff. So that's the ultimate C. And so if we want to see the ultimate C, we got to go deeper, usually, than 2 meters. And so all of this now we call like BC horizons or BW horizons. And we find in this zone, we used to see some, look like stratification in here. And we used to call this some kind of sea horizons. But then if we come down here, this stuff is massive. This isn't, and that what we're seeing up there is actually a cracking pattern. And so this has had some pedogenesis and ought to be recognized as some kind of a B horizon in my estimation. So, but anyway, through that, we get these kind of minerals formed that I'm going to try to tell you more about as we go along through the rest of the talk. And but we do have shells going to gypsum and all those kinds of things. Well, I think mentioned some of these rapid transformations, but one is the rapid formation of iron sulfides when we introduce iron oxide containing minerals into tidal marshes or into some of these reduced sediments. And then, of course, on land, we see the reverse, the rapid transformation back to these minerals when we expose sulfidic materials. And this is some of the work that Marty did back, I guess it's getting close to 20 years ago, and he's still continuing some work like this today. And it's, but he took soil material, the Christiana soil material, I might say this is a 1 centimeter scale, and wrapped it in a porous cloth and buried it out in a tidal marsh. And then he goes back, in this case after 2 years, and digs it back up and sees the rim of sulfide minerals that have formed around it, and whereas opposed to what it looked like in the first place. And then if he goes and looks at thin section, he actually finds that there's not only the monosulfides, which are probably given the bulk of this black color, but also pyrite, which is formed in, and this is actually a framboid of newly formed pyrite. And this, I think this is a reaction that if I ever rewrite a chapter on sulfidization, I think that really a very important reaction is that of hydrogen sulfide with iron oxide materials to make iron sulfides. And actually the reduction of the iron, which is in the ferric form here, to the ferrous form here and here, is by the sulfide, which is undergoing a little bit of oxidation. And so I think that this is a very important reaction. And this is sort of some more recent demonstrations of this. This is one of Marty's workers with his iris tubes, the indicators of reduction in soils, that he's, which are actually PVC pipes painted with ferrihydrite. And this, I might say that Marty is giving a paper on Wednesday morning, I think it's at 10:15, in session 323, which will give much more details on this kind of stuff, and I invite you to attend that paper. But these are these iris tubes, but this is after they've been buried or sunk into the marsh, and after 1 hour, you're already starting to see a little blackening. After 24 hours, much of the tube is blackened, and I'm quite sure this is by the reaction of hydrogen sulfide with the iron oxide. And actually, if he leaves it for up to 96 hours, you see it starts turning white again. That's the underlying pipe. And that's because once all the iron oxides are reacted, the stuff peels off the pipe. And this shows an interesting reaction where he has pulled this tube from that he buried for 24 hours out and let it be exposed to the air for 2 hours. And you can see that the sulfides have oxidized away, or at least they've disappeared, and we're seeing the underlying iron oxides. And so this is, and I don't know the reaction, I don't know if Marty does, for what's the reaction that causes this to go to that? Where is the sulfur going? Is it going off to the atmosphere, maybe, as sulfur dioxide? Now I want to turn and look at some, and I think I don't have time enough to look at this for very long, so I'll go right on to the next slide where I'm trying to illustrate what that we're saying on that past slide is about. And this is actually a deep profile, 6 meters deep, that the surface is right about up there, and there's actually an albaquault soil. The elk was mapped as Elkton soil series. It's Elkton, this doesn't qualify as an albaquault exactly, but anyhow, it's a poorly drained soil over an oxidized zone with jarosite in it. And then we come down to the top of the unoxidized zone where there is gypsum, which is formed, we're absolutely sure, from shells that were in these sediments from the reaction of the sulfuric acid with the shells. And made gypsum. And then we have the unoxidized zone. And I show you this as a, excuse me, Actually, Wagner did some good analyses then of the forms of sulfur and iron in this profile. And you can see down deep, we have about 1% sulfur. Presumably almost all is pyrite, is actually showing a little bit of jarosite and soluble sulfates, and that's because he didn't do his analysis fast enough, and he had some oxidation of the materials after he sampled. But then we come up and we see that in the oxidized zone we have the jarositic iron, but we come all the way up here in the BT type horizons, we don't find any sulfurs. There might be a hundredth of a percent. So, we think what's happening up here is that the jarosite, under some anaerobic conditions, that the iron gets reduced and the jarosite goes into solution. And when it doesn't come back out as jarosite when it reprecipitates because the pH is too high, whereas it had to be something like 3.5 or below to make the jarosite. So that's the jarosite story, but this is the iron story. And I apologize here for Dan Wagner's ignorance in calling these things sea horizons up here in the oxidized zone. This now would be, we call them BCs or BWs. But anyhow, what I do want to call attention to is that the bulk of the iron in the whole profile is silicate iron, presumably from the glauconite, which is in the main silicate mineral in this soil. But the iron sulfides give rise to the iron oxides, which are up here. And just in doing some rough calculations, I think that probably two-thirds or more of the iron, which is in iron oxides in this soil, came from iron sulfides. Oops, going the wrong way again. But now we turn, how much time? 1 minute. Oh my God. Okay. Well, here's some stuff on silicates, and this is a seascape for which we have this profile that was described by Danielle Baldouf, and I'm showing you this to show the properties of this horizon that we have on X-ray diffraction patterns of the clay, and you can see that it's a sulfitic material. Drops in pH when we incubate it. But I'm showing you here a diffraction pattern that shows that with magnesium saturation or whatever, we do have some what she called illite. And maybe some of the potassium in that has come from the seawater. It was also interesting that in this, she peroxided this sample without a buffer. And amazingly, not so amazingly, I guess, she formed jarosite. And the jarosite here is an artifact of her analytical method. And here we're looking at a zone with casts of fossils in it. And this is cemented, we think, by opal CT. And there is some evidence that it sulfuricized the jarosite. I'd love to tell you the story of how I think that thing formed. And finally, a couple of slides just to finally look at a picture that I've probably shown a dozen times before. Anyway, I just want to say that we're in the process now, finally, of trying to get some dates for the time of the formation of this jarosite, which would tell us when the oxidation front came down through this material, 1 meter depth, and it's now oxidized down to 4.5 meters. And you see some of the iron oxide cemented material. But these have been submitted to Dr. Vasconcelos in Australia. And I'd just like to say that one of the things we're thinking of doing is running a lottery on the dates that we're going to get. And then we're going to use this lottery to support a PhD student to really find all the riddles, solve all the riddles that remain about acid sulfate soils. And for backup information, there is a guidebook for the field trip that we ran for the World Congress last year. Has an X-ray diffraction pattern, for example, of this purified jarosite. And also, I want to let you know that there's an International Acid Sulfate Soil conference going to be in South China University next September. I'd love to go, but as present, I'm saying I'm not going. But if you all chip in enough money, I might go. Okay, thank you.